Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
And all day long.
All day long.
The sponsor is?
Pape Machinery.
Da, 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 da.
Pape Machinery is our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They're located in Shasta Lake City. Go up there and see them if you're looking for tractors, implements, lawn care products, steel, Honda. They got it all going on up there. Pretty good inventory right now. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard, and you can get them on the phone at 226-9226 or online at papemachinery.com. So there you go.
And on behalf of Pape Machinery, I'd like to thank the Sheriff's Office, especially the guys that are detailed to Shasta Lake City.
Yes, we keep them on the payroll up there. We have some night visitors every once in a while that like to come up and shop for discounts.
Yes.
But listen, we got them under control. And
the five-finger discount is no longer allowed.
Nope, it's not available.
For those of you who are old enough to know what that means.
Yeah.
And and you know what? Honestly, if you can't control yourself, at least do it during the day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning is not...
people out of bed.
Yeah, don't. That's just rude.
It is, too.
It is rude.
One day you'll catch someone and you throw the book at them.
Yeah. Throw the takedown.
And throw the book at them. Oh, my goodness. So, yeah.
Awful, Andy. Just awful.
You would have been a great sheriff's deputy.
That's right.
I can see it now. You would have been Barney One Bullet. They would have been, I want to roll with Barney One Bullet tonight.
There you go.
Oh, my gosh. Well, so the week that was, nothing noteworthy other than probably the Equality Act. So here's a little free information that the media won't tell you. Please go to congress.gov. It is the Congressional Record site. It is not a Democrat site. It's not a Republican site. It is just the record of what happens with legislation. So when you hear about a bill that is of interest to you, whether it's great or whether it's terrible, go to congress.gov and look it up, provided it's federal. And so you look up like H.R. 5 or H.R. 1 or whatever, and you can see right there on the little dashboard what the co-sponsors look like, who sponsored the bill, what kind of committee work has to be done, where it's going to go. You can actually sign up for alerts so you can follow the bill, the actual happenings of the bill. And you can tell from that, you can tell whether or not it's going to probably go through the Senate. Look at related bills. If you don't see anything on the Senate side, might want to stave off the panic. But at the very least, give your member of the House a call. If that's where it's starting, give them a call and just ask them, hey, what's going on with this bill? Is it going anywhere? So before you go crazy and call and scream at them, just call and ask, is it going anywhere? And they can give you a pretty good indicator. We should only worry about things that we should worry about. The rest of it, we should let that go. Right now, it's very fashionable. The legislation that's going through is, they call them messaging bills, actually. And the message is to their own guys, oh my gosh, aren't we awesome? We just passed some crazy thing that you all love. And the message to the other guys is, your life sucks. We're going to trounce you, and we're going to ruin your life, and America as we know it is now gone. It's an easy message. Like that picture in your mom's bathroom, Bill. You know, the guy with the little stick and the parcel over his shoulder.
Oh, yeah, with a fork in the road.
Yeah, yeah, the road less traveled.
That's right.
So it only goes...
The road no longer an option.
Oh, God, that's right. That's what we never had the heart to ask what that was about. Just double check. Make sure that it's truly coming. But on the other hand, the messaging bills, those are also a clue. They function as clues because that means that's stuff they really do want to do, and it may come back in a different form or fashion in the future. So it is kind of worth getting smart about it. But I'm not big on panic, so hold on to your panic until you make sure it's real. And what's happening? I opened up the pneumonia hole in here. It's getting colder. it was stuffy when we got in. All right. Well, I'm gonna introduce Elaine. Are you playing with the thermostat? Yep. Playing with the thermostat. All right. On to Elaine, who is on the phone with us. Elaine Willman, we have not had on the show for 4 years. I could not believe it. I had to keep scrolling back farther and farther and farther and farther to find her last program with us. And I'm so bad, I didn't even realize she wrote a new book last year until I was talking to somebody else, and they said, well, hey, you should have her on. She just wrote a new book, actually. That's what I was told. And then I went on Amazon. I'm like, oh, my God, it was a year ago. So she has a really interesting insight on what goes on with policy related. This whole place is good. It's like Three Stooges radio. Steve Edge can't see it all. Robert's working on our puffy things on the wall there. All right, there. I think we got it. Good Lord.
Eggshells were egg cartons are coming down.
Exactly. The fluffy things. So Elaine Willman is the author of Going to Pieces, The Dismantling of the United States of America. I really think you would like this book. She also has them out in Kindle and everything. I've put links on the site, which is wethepeopleradio.us, by the way, if you want to follow along or send us notes or phone calls or whatever. The book reports first-person visits and experiences of tribal members and citizens residing on or near 17 different Indian reservations. She took a road trip across the country from Washington State to New York State, which is basically across the country. There's not much left. And her book is awesome. I think you'll really like it. I have not read the newest one, and that was kind of what we were going to talk about. But her second one was called Slumbering Thunder, a primer for confronting the spread of federal Indian policy and tribalism that's overwhelming America. And interestingly enough, I think that actually we see a lot of some of the policy things I alluded to earlier, like H.R. 5. That kind of policy is creating an element of tribalism as well. So we're all going to have to, you know, I don't know, we can't get our stars like the Sneetches because they've been banned, but I guess we'll have to get some sort of demarcation to know what tribe we're in ultimately, even outside of this policy. So Elaine, we've got like a minute or two until our break, but and then we'll talk nothing about, you know, nothing except your book. But what do you want to tell people for, like, a setup on this thing?
Well, Aaron, first, thanks, and it's just great to connect with you again.
I know. I could not believe it had been 4 years.
I know, but I think it's been a crazy 4 years for all of us in the country, of course.
And, that's true.
And so time flies. So it's really delightful to be with you, and I do want to talk about the book, of course, but I also want to talk about some broader issues, too, that are affecting us all today. So let's just kind of freewheel. What do you think?
Absolutely. And I kind of didn't say it, but the book is called American Tribal Tyranny, How Federal Indian Policy Secretly Monies Up Elected Officials, Forcing American Taxpayers to Fund All Annual Operating Needs of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And so I guess if you're thinking, well, I don't live anywhere near an Indian reservation, I don't think this is going to affect me. Bottom line is, if you live in the country and you're a taxpayer, that's where it's affecting you.
Yeah, it funds not only that behemoth federal agency, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, it annually funds all the basic needs of 576 tribal governments, too. So that's a huge chunk of taxpayer dollars, probably equivalent to the military funding that the taxpayers are paying without actually knowing about it. Most folks have not been on reservations. And, of course, the two coastal populations probably only think of Indian casinos, and they don't realize just how much of the taxpayer dollar is removing a republic form of government in the various states and converting it to tribalism or culture, you know, collectivism. And that, and this is why I want to talk about other things too.
Sure.
This tribalism and this spread of collectivism is now being parroted or, you know, picked up by other cultures and other groups who think, well, Indians can do their thing, we can do our thing, and there you go. We're losing less and less of our republic form of government to collectivism.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and that moves me.
And it's always done in a way that either you can't, because most people couldn't have an intelligent conversation about this, not because they're not intelligent, but because this is stuff we just don't know a lot about. If you live if you live in an area, that's how I first got connected with Elaine. Was she was up in Montana near the Flathead Reservation, or on the Flathead Reservation, and when it comes to water policy, and tribes, there's a lot of impact to local communities, local counties, and local taxpayers. Good and bad. I mean, depends on where you live and what's going on, but it is a factor. So we need to take a really quick break. We'll come right back with our guest, Elaine Willman. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. What shall we do about them when they move into your neighborhood? They take over, but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. We're so glad you could attend. Come inside, come inside. There behind the glass stands a real blade of grass. Be careful as you pass. Move along, move along. Come inside, the show's about to start. Guaranteed to blow your head apart. Rest assured, don't get your money's worth. We're the show.
We don't really want to make your head blow apart. We're going to do our level best to inject a little fun or something, because it seems like everything these days is designed to make your head blow apart. So, you know, we should talk a little bit about your background, Elaine, before we get going.
Well, as a background, I was like you and most folks in the country. I knew nothing about Indian reservations or anything like that, having lived down in Southern California, Ventura County, Ojai, for 15 years before moving up to Washington State. And when I took a position with a little city in Washington State, it was in the middle of the Yakima Indian Reservation. And I was thinking, because I am Cherokee and my husband is Shoshone, I was thinking, oh, hooray, I get to live on a real Indian reservation, and very excited to do that. And so that was the beginning of my information and education on Indian policy and interaction, you know, between local governments and tribal governments. I lived on the Yakima Reservation for 16 years. Then I took a position with a wonderful community in Wisconsin, which happened to be on the Oneida Indian Reservation, and I was there for 8 years. And then folks here in western Montana were in a huge water battle with the federal government and the tribe, where the state of Montana was, and it currently is, willing to give all of its state waters in western Montana, all those counties that border Idaho, is going to give all of its state waters to the federal government in trust for one little tribe to control all of the waters in western Montana. And so folks in Montana invited me out to help them fight that little fight. And by my second or third visit out here, I thought, I have to get in the middle of this. And my family was willing to move, so we moved out to the middle of nowhere, Montana. I like to say that the Beverly Hillbillies moved to the little house on the prairie, because we live out in this beautiful, beautiful valley between the Rockies. There's only one other rooftop in the whole valley. So it was quite a life change, but we just love it. And there's wonderful people out here. So I've been on this reservation for 6 years. I think I've lived on Indian reservations for the past almost 30 years. And many of, if not most of our friends are tribal families and such as that. So my research is, on behalf of tribal members who have no voice with their tribal governments, and it's all focused on congressional acts, judicial rulings, federal agency regulations. It's all on policy. It has, because I have a tremendous affection for the American Indian culture. It's my own ancestry, it's my own culture, and I really value the culture and the traditions of tribal families and Indian culture, but they are truly held kind of captive by a tribal government that does not afford them with their constitutional rights or any such thing. So that's kind of where I'm coming from. I try to speak on behalf of tribal members and non-Indians. Almost all of the Indian reservations are overwhelmingly populated by non-Indians. So that's kind of some background. And then I wrote, as you mentioned, the Going to Pieces book in 2005 from that wacky road trip I took with a big videographer from Washington to New York. And that book continues to be a really good seller. And the Slumbering Thunder book was a collection of my experiences working with the various local governments in conflict or collaboration with tribal governments. And I really hadn't planned to do a third book until something came across that just enraged me. I don't watch CNN. I will
unless you want to be enraged.
Most people don't, yeah. Elaine.
I will cop to being a strong conservative. So there for a while, I was a strict Fox News viewer. And on Fox News, they ran a CNN clip. And it was a clip about this. This was a few years ago. 3 years ago, I think it was. No, 2 years ago. And this clip had this handsome Navajo chairman, tribal chairman, Russell Begay. Handsome, marvelous Indian face and shoulder shot on CNN. And mind you, CNN is in every airport in the world.
True.
And this Indian leader is on CNN, and his statement was, all of America is Indian country, and every non-Indian is a guest and should act like it.
Oh.
And he said that, and I backed it up and watched it again to make sure I heard him right. All of America is Indian country, and every non-Indian is a guest and should act like it. I just went ballistic, blind rage. I had to settle down for 2 weeks before I could even confront it rationally, you know what I mean? So, and that's when I thought, by God, I'm writing another book. And so the first, that's the American Tribal Tyranny book, the new one. And the first chapter is my open letter to Russell Begay, letting him know exactly what I think about his comments on CNN. And this third book, I wrote in a very different style than the other two. I wanted to keep it extremely simple. There's no big words in it. I don't have a lot of annotations or stuff like that. But I wanted to keep it simple and absolutely clearly define what federal Indian policy is and how tremendously unconstitutional and illegal it all always has been. So that was the American Tribal Tyranny book. And because I don't know if it's because I put simple language in it and spoke very snarky and queer, or whether it also had pictures in it. I don't know why, but this book is really selling. I mean, I've had a fellow put up 2 billboards along major highways here in Montana with the cover of my book on it. And one fellow ordered 500 copies, and I've had lots of bulk orders for 150 copies. And it's really selling, bigger than the first two, which tickles me to death. Because of my whole point is to educate people that don't live on reservations, the taxpayers that are subjected to this. We're truly indentured servants. Every taxpayer is an indentured servant to this system we had nothing to do with, and this system that is totally authorized under a War Powers Act, which may not be implemented in states, but has been since the 1830s. It's a completely unconstitutional, illegal system that, a national organization that I belong to has been researching this for 20 years, the War Powers Act specifically. And we finally have it confronted in the court case up in front of the Supreme Court right now, a case called U.S. v. Cooley, C-O-O-L-E-Y. So that's kind of big picture. I've just been, I don't know why I cannot not do this. I don't know why it's so important to me. I've been focused on federal Indian policy, as I said, for about 30 years. but I think it's because it is so far apart from our Constitution, what our founders intended, mm-hmm. and the spread of collectivism instead of individual responsibility and individual liberty and aspiration.
What's the overall reception for your books with, let's say, the majority of the tribal members that you've talked to? Are they pretty much behind what you're doing or not?
The tribal members appreciate them. Mm-hmm. And we have long conversations. As I said, I try to speak on their behalf because they dare not speak up for themselves in these
right.
tribal governments. The tribal governments are not fond of me at all.
No, I wouldn't think so.
The National Congress of American Indians and several Indian organizations, political organizations and lobbyists and whatnot, they call me every name in the book, and they have for all these years, but I don't care what they call me.
Well, I think that, like, when you came on with us a long time ago, because I speak with people all the time who, say, took a job at a casino that's on uh-huh. tribal ground, and they're shocked that they don't have the full protections, basically, of the Constitution. It's like the
their working conditions and all that are not covered under.
Sometimes it's great
labor laws.
I mean, we have local establishments here that are great. People really like them. They like working for them. But then there are other ones that aren't great. And the problem is your recourse is pretty much zero.
And that's a good point, Aaron, because some of the tribal governments are very decent with their people and run wonderful businesses. There are exceptions to this, absolutely. But predominantly, they're really brutal on their people and customers at a lot of these casinos are not aware that if they're, if they're on federal trust land, and their car's in a parking lot and gets vandalized or they slip and fall someplace, they have no protections on that federal trust land. And in those all-you-can-eat casinos, a very few of them are subject to food inspections or state food inspections. And so you're at your own risk when you're in a tribal business or on a tribal property, and a lot of folks don't know that they certainly don't advertise that
well. And what you had I've listed the shows, the previous shows we did with you, and I do hope people will go back and listen, because we're not going to obviously retread all of that, but what you discovered was that members of the tribe basically forfeited their constitutional rights as Americans by living on the reservation. They were under the control of the tribal government, and I never forgot it. It was years ago, and yet I remember when you told us that if they vote against the wrong tribal council people, they can mm-hmm. take their children away. They could do all sorts of things, and they have no. Their complaints go right back to the people who are orchestrating that.
Yes, and I think part of the problem is that these congressional acts that have been put into place on behalf of tribal governments are made by the folks back in Washington, D.C., and I would venture that over the last century or two, very few of those elected officials in D.C. and Congress have ventured out across the country or even been on the reservation. But there are lobbyists, tribal lobbyists, that get in there, and one of the most egregious things Congress did
hold that thought, because we'll have questions. But my engineer is ready to he's tying a noose in there right now because I blew right by the break time, and Bill of course is Bill of course is doing his own show over
here. I'm holding, but it's important. All
right. Oh my gosh, we'll be right back. Our guest is Elaine Willman. She is the author of, and I just moved my cursor off of it, American Tribal Tyranny. And you're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Ready for clothes. Oh, Mississippi, that she's calling my name. Catfish are jumping, that paddle wheel bumping. Black water keep rolling on fast, just the same.
Oh, black water, keep on rolling.
Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining on me?
Oh, black water, keep on rolling.
Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining on me?
Oh, black water, keep on rolling.
Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining?
Moon horizon.
We're back. All right, Elaine. Sorry. Finish that thought.
Well, speaking of one of the worst bills Congress or acts that Congress ever passed, and that was the Indian Child Welfare Act. I love how these acts have these marvelous titles and they're just the opposite.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but yeah. Lobbyists, that's trademark.
Lobbyists, yeah, like we have the Montana Water Protection Act, which is giving all our Montana waters to a tribe. And not protecting anybody in Montana. But anyway, the Indian Child Welfare Act, because of a whole bunch of tribal lobbyists going into Congress and wringing their hands and saying, my people, your state adoption agencies are allowing Indian children to be adopted by non-Indian parents, and we're losing our culture. So the Congress gives them the Indian Child Welfare Act, which transferred all full parental rights from a tribal parent to the tribal government. And so our enrolled tribal members across the country do not have parental rights over their children 18 and under. Their tribal government does. And that was what Congress's way of helping the tribal government protect its culture. So, and that is weaponized by tribal governments to keep their members in line. For example, when I first moved out here in 2016, I attended a hearing in the state legislature in Helena, and a couple of tribal fellows stood up to the microphone. The hearing was about the transfer of a major hydropower dam from the state to the tribe, the federal government and the tribe. And a couple of Indian fellows stood up at the microphone, and they both said, do not give this dam to our tribe. They do not have the experience. They will not do right. Do not do that. And a couple days later, they got knocks on their doors from the Tribal Child Protective Services saying, you're a bad parent. We're taking your children. And they took three girls from one family, and the other fellow was a grandfather who had full custody of his two grandsons. They took those boys from him. And the family that lost the three girls, it took almost 3 years for them to get two of the girls back, and they are still, and this was in 2016, they are still trying to get their third daughter back. And the grandfather who lost his grandsons still does not have his children back.
And do they just place them wherever they want?
They place them with other families, but the parents don't necessarily know the other families, or even if they do, it's too bad. They just remove them from the family and place them in another tribal family. And that's the way it goes. So that's what happens when you speak up against a tribal government decision. If you're an enrolled tribal member, it comes with retaliation of some kind. Wow. And my way of thinking, removing a child is the worst. But it can be the loss of a job, or the loss of housing, it can be any number, it can be shunning or whatever they do. The retaliation is wide-ranging. So, and Congress made that possible. You know, and these are, as Aaron mentioned, enrolled tribal members are full American citizens like you and me. They have all the same constitutional rights as you and I until they are enrolled. And they're subject to their tribal government, then they lose their constitutional rights, their unalienable rights. They lose free speech. They lose it all under that government. And consequently, about 4 out of 5 American Indians have left the reservations and disenrolled, and they have nothing to do. Your Indian reservations are pretty small in population. This is a pretty good Flathead where I live, Indian reservation, a pretty good sized reservation, and it only has 5,000 enrolled tribal members here, where we have like 35,000 non-Indians that live on this reservation.
That seems kind of telling.
The Cherokees are huge. You know, there's 300,000 or something like that. But most of your tribal populations are very small, very small, but huge governments.
And what kind of control do they have over the people who are not enrolled tribal members who live on the reservation?
They're supposed to have none. They have none.
Okay.
Tribal government. We have a big Montana Supreme. The U.S. Supreme Court case is a landmark case that came out of Montana, that tribal governments have no authority whatsoever over non-Indians or non-Indian properties or persons. Or properties are, they have no authority over non-Indians whatsoever, period. But when you live within the boundaries of an Indian reservation, the tribal governments will bully. They'll pretend they do, or they'll throw something at you that makes you think they do. And if you haven't educated yourself and comply, then you have agreed to let them govern you. For example, if one signs an agreement or any kind of a consent, any kind of document with a tribal government, if you're a non-Indian and you sign some form of agreement, like a vendor might or anybody else might, the moment you sign a document with a tribal government, you have subjected yourself to be governed by that tribal government and can be called into their tribal court. You won't be able to bring in your own attorney. You can only bring in the limited attorneys that they allow to practice in their court. And you won't be given, you know, due process. The tribal courts are largely kangaroo. So I always like to tell non-Indians, be careful about signing anything with a tribal government or a tribal business, because that can trap you.
Yeah, you could be giving up more than you planned on.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
And so, why? What's the? I mean, there are always multiple motives for this kind of stuff, but it's, you know, well, almost the, always power and control.
The tribal governments have, they claim a sovereignty. Now it's a quasi, what we call a quasi-dependent sovereignty. Their sovereignty is an extension of the federal government's sovereignty. It isn't a clear and separate sovereignty, but they like to think it is and act like it is. And behind their sovereign principles, their governing authority, they tend to embellish and expand that at every single opportunity. And so one has to be mindful of that. That's how they grow their land base. Actually, you know, the bigger picture is that these tribal governments and Indian reservations are very willing pawns and tools of the federal government, which constantly is trying to expand its federal jurisdiction and federal footprint in states, removing state authority over its lands and natural resources and waters. So, you know, in the western states, there's already a ton of federal land in all the western states. But expanding, you know, when tribes buy land and place it into federal trust on their behalf, that's land that comes out of a state's tax base or a state's ability to generate revenue. These tribal governments are shrinking incrementally every year the authority of states over their lands and natural resources and economies and water. And that's just something that is continuously diminishing state lands and state sovereign authority that is not recoverable by states. And state legislators, who are dependent upon federal subsidies for their state budgets, are only too willing to just say, oh, okay. States are under a twofold pressure. One, they get a lot of federal subsidies, and so when the feds kind of push out on the state control, states cave, And the other thing is that since gaming came on in 1988 and in 2000, tribal governments can now, they're the only governments in the country that can cut checks to election, you know, elected officials, incumbents or candidates, and they do that in large number. They own Washington State. They own the governor's office, the state legislature. There's 31 tribes in little Washington State, and they money up those elected officials to do their bidding. They totally control Washington State.
So do they? So the reservations don't operate under the same campaign laws that everybody else does? Is that what you're saying?
Right. Right. And the way that happened was just before the Bush-Gore election in 2000, one tribe in New York, the Oneidas of New York, wrote a letter to the Federal Election Commission saying, may we participate financially in federal and state elections? And the FEC said, why, sure, to this one tribe. Well, then you have to treat all tribes the same. That immediately spread out to all tribes. And so you have 574 tribes in, I think, something like 28 states. And their casino money, which is free money because taxpayers fund all their basic needs, their casino money goes to buy legislators, land, lobbyists, lawyers. Their casino money helps them grow their voice. I mean, they're a very small population of America, but they have an enormous financial and political voice in D.C. And in your state capitals where there are Indian reservations.
Hmm. Yeah. I think it's really worth educating people on this because it's really something, unless you did a little bit of study, probably would not stumble across it. Or you live in a rural area and you're finding that your water policy and all that is super jammed up, and then you start realizing, hey, how'd the federal government get all that control? We have to take a really quick break. Our guest is Elaine Willman, and her book is American Tribal Tyranny. Thanks for joining us. You are listening to We the People Radio. You can find us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
It ain't my time.
Meaning what they say now, and never saying what they mean. While they while away the hours in their ivory towers, till they're covered up with flowers in the back of a black limousine. Whoa, la da 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 da. Talking about you.
And we're back.
All right. Are you back?
Yep.
Well, you guys have a great taste in music. I love your music that you put out.
We do what we can.
It's great. So, one thing I think that I'd like the folks to know is how one voice or two voices can make a difference and where this stuff all came from. And it goes back, you know, the original 13 colonies, every colony, and the states, the original 13 states, managed their entire population within their state, including their Indians. States managed the Indians. And then there were two men that grew up together in Virginia, two young men that grew up together, and they became political rivals. And one of them became President Andrew Jackson, a populist and a big states' rights guy. And the other one was Chief Justice John Marshall, who was the first and most prominent and probably longest-serving Chief Justice of our Supreme Court. And those two gentlemen were fierce adversaries. Marshall was a strong central government. He believed in a big, powerful federal central government, and Jackson believed in states' rights. So a situation came up in the state of Georgia around 1829 and 1830, where the Cherokee Nation informed the state of Georgia that it would manage its lands and its reservations, and Georgia had no authority on its Cherokee reservation. And the state of Georgia said, well, I don't think so. And President Andrew Jackson said, oh, hell no. And that caused, for better or for worse, mostly for worse, the Indian Removal Act, which removed the Indians west of the Mississippi. Marshall was infuriated, and Marshall actually did some things that Chief Justice would be impeached for. Marshall found some friends in Virginia and educated them on how to bring a case up to his court, in fact, several cases up to his court. And in 1830, in a case called Worcester v. Georgia, Chief Justice John Marshall ruled, and you could find nothing in our U.S. Constitution, so he used British international law. Marshall ruled that the federal government had a trust relationship with Indians. That's where this came from. That Marshall's ruling of Worcester v. Georgia in 1830, the federal government has a trust relationship with Indians. They are dependent wards of the federal government. And that was the origin that removed the states managing their Indian populations, took it away from the states, gave it to the federal government in trust. Well, Congress didn't know what to do with that, but they soon formed the Bureau of Indian Affairs under the Secretary of War then. And the Bureau of Indian Affairs, using the war powers, they needed the war powers. The lands in the western side of the Mississippi mostly were territories, but they needed the war powers to manage hostile Indians and even war powers during the Civil War and such. So all of Indian authority is founded under the war powers authority, which is applicable in territories, because residents in territories are not U.S. citizens, and the war powers is the controlling power in territories. But once land is formed into a state and becomes a state, the federal government cannot use war powers against the state. But that has continued with Indian policy. That is how the federal government, the Bureau, the BIA, has expanded Indian reservations and progressed all of this stuff across the country to the year 2021 under the War Powers Act.
Hmm. Why do you suppose nobody's ever challenged that? I mean, is it just precedent now, and that's why it's not challenged?
There's a whole bunch of reasons why it's not been challenged. And one would be economic, because as I said, in the western states, when they came to their statehood, a lot of them included a lot of federal land. You don't see that in the eastern states, but you see a lot of federal land in western states, even upon their statehood. And because of that, the states are given what they call payment in lieu of taxes. They're given federal subsidies, or PILT money, and the states rely on that for their budgets. So there's a monetary reason why states tend to acquiesce. And then there's also the political sensitivity that elected officials have. They really don't like to be called racist. And if you say no to any tribal desire, you're a racist. And so there's a lot of reasons why the states just don't cave. And more recently, the tribes buy the elected officials with their gaming money. They buy them. Mm. They own the governor's. They've owned the Washington governor's office since Governor Lowry. Oh, and here's the other thing that happened. The federal government has a trust relationship with Indians, but states do not. But Governor Lowry, Mike Lowry, back in 1989, which happened to be 1 year after the Gaming Act came in 1989, that was Washington State's centennial. And Governor Lowry created this centennial accord honoring the first 100 years of Washington State. And within that accord, he created a state trust relationship with Washington's tribes. and he set up state Indian offices in all the state agencies in Washington State. And that has been replicated by Montana and I think Oregon, several other states. So now these tribes are double dipping. They're getting federal dollars every year for their basic needs, and they're getting state dollars from the various state agencies too. But states legally have no trust relationship with the tribes. But they like that tribal campaign money.
Yeah. You know,
that's what's going on today.
See, and the hard part, too, the payment in lieu of taxes, not to gloss that over,
yeah.
That is a huge budgetary concern, especially like some of our counties here could be upwards of 60 to 70% public land. Well, when you do that, there's no property tax revenue. There's just all the things that go with private ownership. But the bad part is that because of the configuration of the country, you have a huge percentage of the representatives who don't really understand that anymore, and they've started looking at it like rural welfare, actually. So the Pilt battle every year is it gets pushed off farther and farther and farther, and then it always gets thrown in with something at the last minute. So
you gotta
watch those kinds of agreements, because over time they lose their meaning, and then you run the risk of winding up standing there, you know, getting like these guys in the movies, you handcuff themselves to the bed, and then, nothing good's going to happen from here.
Well, it goes back to the fundamentals in our Constitution, one of which is the federal government is required to timely dispose of its territories. Timely dispose of its territory, which caused, you know, all the formation of these states. Well, it did timely dispose of its territories in the eastern states, but it did not timely dispose of its territories in the western states. And so you get that little expansion where, well, we're just not going to do that over here, you know. And then there's another little teeny little phrase in the Constitution that says that the federal government has authority over Indian commerce. That's Indian commerce, because in the early days, the early 1800s, there were some shenanigans in bartering with Indians and unfair exchanges of beads or whatever. And so the founders put federal authority over Indian commerce in the Constitution. It didn't say authority over land or Indian jurisdiction over anything.
Hold that thought, Elaine. We're going to get cut off by the news, but we're going to come back and talk about this some more. Our guest is Elaine Willman. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day.